Welcome back to another episode of MedTech Trends. I'm your host, Dorian. So today we have with us two guests. They're coming from Luxembourg, I believe. So I'll introduce them and then we'll get right into it. So we have Ziad Tayeb, who is the CEO and co-founder of a company called Mylan S and Mylan H. There are actually two companies. He is a researcher on brain-computer interfaces and neuroprosthetics at the Technical University of Munich. That's TUM for short. And we also have Samahar Garbaya, who is the chief operating officer and also a co-founder of Mylan S and Mylan H. Her background includes deep learning for object detection, recognition, and localization. She has a background in finance and modeling. And prior to co-founding these companies, she also worked in fintech. So welcome to both of you. Thanks so much for coming on the show this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having us. We are flattered you've taken the time to talk to us, and we highly appreciate your interest in what we are doing at Mylan S and Mylan H.
Awesome. This is going to be an awesome conversation too. I was really looking forward to this. And again, we'll get into a lot more detail about what you guys are working on with both companies, Mylan H and Mylan S. Before we get into that too, let me just kind of lay out the mission of these two companies as it shows up on your website. The two separate websites, and we'll include a link in the description. So for Mylan H, which is the health technology company, their mission is to allow clinicians to remotely diagnose and monitor the health statuses of patients anywhere, anytime, regardless of physical locations. And Mylan S, which is the space technology company, their mission is to bring neuromorphic computing for in-space autonomy and making new studies in human-robot cooperation in outer space. Really, really interesting. I love the hybrid approach here of space and medicine, two of my favorite areas, by the way, I should mention. So today we'll talk a lot about both of those companies. To lay the groundwork here for this conversation, off the top, I think I already know the answer, but what is the S and H? What do they stand for in Mylan? And where do those names come from?
Yeah, I think I leave the floor to Samaher to explain. She has got like a pretty kind of defined like definition of what does it stand for?
Perfect.
Okay, thank you, Ziad. Thank you, Dorian. So mainly the S is for space and H is for healthcare. We chose myelin because of the personal story we have, as this is a substance in the brain that gets damaged by multiple sclerosis. It's also the symbol of intelligence.
Symbol of intelligence. Okay. Is there like a longer kind of history to that? Like, is it the symbol? Myelin, I just think of as like the cell, the basic cell structure in the nervous system.
Yeah, exactly. But then if you look at it, like, if you go to the nervous system and try to understand the myelin, they actually, speed up the learning process in the brain. So they speed up the propagation of the nervous messages and throughout the body and different parts of the body, specifically in the brain and the spinal cord. And that's why it's kind of, it's kind of gave us the inspiration to use it as a symbol for intelligence.
Nice and simple. It gets straight to the point. And I think it was pretty the S and the H are pretty intuitive. So I found it easy to kind of distinguish between the two. So that's always a positive. And I'm also really curious about your academic backgrounds, and also how both of you kind of came together to create this the foundation, I guess, that then became Mylan S and Mylan H. In terms of your backgrounds, how did you guys kind of get into this space, and how did both of you end up meeting to create this company?
Yeah, great. I mean, it's kind of interesting in like how diverse and versatile the background we have. So for me, for example, I actually did my engineering studies in Tunisia. This is where I come from originally. And I remember like back in 2015, I did my master's thesis. I built my own prosthesis, and I kind of played around, built my own electronics and sensors, and they used like very simple machine learning, like support vector machine, to decode brain signals and muscle activity and control a prosthetic hand. And I kind of the idea was just to follow like a normal career, a normal professional career. Unfortunately, my mother was late stage diagnosed with multiple sclerosis back then, actually during my graduation day. And I decided to kind of take a complete U-turn on my standpoint and abandon all the jobs and offers I got back then. And then I said, okay, I want to become a scientist, and I want to kind of tackle or work you know, at the intersection between neuroscience and engineering. So bridging the gap between those two fields. And then I started worked for the HBB. This is like for Human Brain Project, one of the largest European projects in neuroengineering. I worked there like for a year. I was building, you know, different brain models and deploy them in robots to get them, you know, smarter. Like I remember I had a publication about the olfactory system of insects and put that inside the robot, you know, to learn how to discriminate between like different objects and so on. And then back in 2017, I decided to start my PhD. I said, okay, now I want to like, you know, this dream is getting through and I want to start a PhD. I did my PhD in brain machine interfaces. That's where I'm actually very fascinated about. And then at some point when the pandemic started, I said it's probably like the right moment to start the company. First of all, we started in 2019 with Mylan S. That's where I actually brought this expertise and knowledge from 2015 to 2016, where I was doing neuromorphic computing for the HPP project. And I said, like, okay, with Samer, we said, okay, let's put this technology in the hand of experts in space. And then following that, early this, you know, 2021, we started Mylan H, and now it's like kind of, you know, we're closing, or it's like the full spectrum, because now I feel like I'm hyperbolically excited to build something that can help my mother probably regain mobility again, or at least, you know, stop or slow down the progression of the disease. So I lived, you know, for Samer, I think we met each other. She was doing her master's thesis in deep learning. Back then I was like kind of, you know, I think I'm a bit knowledgeable when it comes to that. And she asked me, I think she reached out, she shoot me a message asking for help for like, I think she was coding and she had some bugs. And then we exchanged a couple of emails, and then all of a sudden I became like her co-supervisor. And after she finished the thesis, they said, why not, you know, because she used like the open source version of the software. So okay. She said, I want to continue using this, but for commercial purposes. So why not starting a company here? And that was kind of was like the cornerstone, or like the beginning of the whole journey.
There's a lot of detail there, so we'll unpack that and how all this kind of came to be.
Yeah.
So Maher, you were also working in doing like financial modeling, or you were doing kind of object recognition using AI, developing your own algorithms at the time. And were you working in the same university, same organization as Ian?
Okay, so let me begin introducing my engineering is modeling and applied mathematics. So this is my specialty. So there are different parts there. So there are the finance, where I did different projects in finance and I worked there. It was good experience, but when I worked on the project in signal processing and developing probabilistic models for different machine learning applications, and I saw these applications in healthcare, I'm moving a little bit from finance, not as I'm using now finance as application in business, not as the field of finance. So this is a little bit of moving more toward business and applying finance there. But let me start from the beginning. So I'm Samaher Garbaya. I'm a modeling and applied mathematics engineer by training. My background is, as I said, signal processing and developing probabilistic models for different machine learning applications. It could be in space, in finance, and in healthcare. Besides the technical background, I'm now moving more towards business development and setting new strategies to our businesses, Mylan S and Mylan H. And I think this is a little bit exciting to take the technical background and apply this in different businesses that are impactful in our life. So this is amazing, I think.
Awesome. I love the cross-pollination of these different disciplines, and of course the same algorithms, the same approaches can be applied in a lot of different fields. So it's awesome that you took up that mantle and pursued other interesting applications, especially in healthcare. We know that healthcare tends to lag behind. I mean, it in a lot of ways it kind of has to borrow technology and concepts and theory and other things from other fields. It's only now sort of really starting to ramp up, and it's really cool to hear about these sort of algorithms working their way into healthcare. And the part that you mentioned also about your focus going forward on business development within both Myelin S and Myelin H, super important. So I do want to come back to that point as well in terms of how the companies are growing, your partnerships, and what you foresee for the future. Again, to lay the foundation a little bit more for this conversation. So essentially, I think we're talking about these, brain computer interfaces, whether that is applied to healthcare or to space technologies. But essentially, it's brain computer interfaces. They've been around for a long time, decades. I read a little bit into this. I think as far back as 1970s, maybe even before that. But there and a lot of companies have come around in the last decade or so. Some pretty well-known companies as well. At the same time, though, the applications are still fairly niche. The only exception I can think of is like virtual reality, if we want to put it under the same umbrella here. That's the only thing that's become very popular. But I'm trying to understand, I'd love to hear your thoughts on this. How is it that these technologies, that they've technically been around for a long time, they're not very widespread, and yet they offer a lot of potential impact both in healthcare and in space for spacecraft as well. So what's the current state of the field, and what are some of the skeptics saying?
Yeah, I think it's a great question. As you said, I think the brain machine interface has sparked the interest of many scientists and engineers around the globe, and I think it's now getting momentum. I mean, if you see, like, for example, DARPA started a new project, it's called N3, whose mission actually to build brain machine interface, a bidirectional one, to help like for the military applications and robotics and well beyond that. Indeed, I mean, the field has been around for quite some time. The problem is actually, I think the main bottleneck in BCI is the fact that if you go invasive, then many people will just be reluctant and they don't want to deploy this BCI because they don't see kind of the application, and it might become like a bit dangerous. And now if we just scratch the surface, if we are just non-invasively, which means EEG or MEG, then the problem is we are lacking the kind of spatial resolution, because there are like billions of neurons in the brain. And we are just listening. You can imagine like someone is outside the stadium and then listening to like a wide range of audience talking inside the stadium. That's actually what's happening when you were picking those tiny microvolt changes in the brain. This is like what we know EEG. So the problem with that is actually the spatial resolution. Now, if you look at MRI or fMRI, then you have a high spatial resolution, but the problem is the temporal resolution. You can't actually pick the changes at the millisecond. So I think this trade-off between going invasive or kind of the level of invasiveness is the question here in BCI. And this is what why the field has not kind of flourished yet. I would be touching upon how we are kind of disrupting and revolutionizing the brain machine interface. But I still believe like this is the future. If you see like the landscape of funding programs by NIH and DARPA and so on, I think everybody is now looking into BCI and what can be done there, specifically when it comes to brain diseases diagnosis. I think robotics is going to be limited anyway, unless we go invasive, because the number of degrees of freedom you can decode from like non-invasive methods is still very low. I mean, you can't go beyond this four different movements. That's impossible.
There's also been a lot of focus on neuroprosthetics. This is really just kind of another way, I think, of saying what you were mentioning about. I mean, there's the proxy, I think we can think of it that way, in terms of funding from NIH or from DARPA. you know, what's their interest or what's one of their big interests, it would be in things like neuroprosthetics. So this is a field where a lot of the milestones in BCI have come from to begin with. It's also where a lot of the funding is aligned. And at the same time, it seems to be offering the most promise in terms of bringing this technology to light into the general public, where everyone can sort of see it. Would that be an accurate thing to say?
Yeah, I would say that's true. I mean, I did my PhD specifically in the area of neuroprosthetics and applying brain machine interfaces in neuroprosthesis. And I think there are two things. The first one is, if you use brain machine interface, even invasive methods, in with someone who lost their arms, then I think they wouldn't mind if they have a BCI, even if it's invasive, because usually those people, they have spinal cord injury or they're completely paralyzed. So something that can help them regain mobility, I think it's just fabulous for them. So they don't mind having invasive methods. But if you see BCI in neuroprosthetics for example, amputees, then I think the most promising part is sensory feedback. So one of the things I did in my PhD, and I actually was closely collaborating with people from DARPA and from the Applied Physics Lab through this revolutionizing prosthetics project, is we tried to actually restore the sense of touch. So we basically take those sensors, they change their resistance when, you know, you apply high pressure, and then we take that signal and we send it back we actually rewire that with a nerve, and then we try to give that person-like sensation back. For example, distinguishing between very sharp and pointy objects versus round curvature, and distinguishing between applying high force and low force. You may ask, why do we care about that? But the problem is, if you don't have the sense of touch, then you have to constantly look at your prosthesis when grabbing objects. And that's one of the promising areas where BCI makes sense, because then you have a closed loop system. You actually think about the action, you can decode it or through the muscles, and then at the same time you receive feedback through your nerves. That's, I think, the most kind of exciting applications of BCI I see in neuroprosthetics.
The way that you're framing it right now is, it sounds like it's a combination of, or correct me if I'm wrong, but a combination of invasive and non-invasive sort of techniques combined. Would that be the sort of the optimal way of applying BCI?
Yeah, I think this is what people say, semi-invasive methods, where you actually combine both, like what we call, I mean, it's again, because we have the scalp and then we have the skull and then we can go to the local field potential. So I think if we just scratch the surface, put some electrodes, this is actually what Neuralink is trying to do, then we are kind of semi-invasive. And then that's, I think, the future, I would guess. And this is also what the literature is showing us. But EG, I think for neuroprosthetics, might be very challenging.
I would concur. So that's not my immediate area of expertise, but I've read a little bit on this subject as well. So I wanted to now dive into quite a bit more about how Myelin H is structured and the solution that you guys offered, and also how you've kind of transitioned from this initial software, essentially, that you built out this toolbox into a commercialized product. And I believe you guys are also in the process of testing it again with the intent of actually commercializing it or expanding its commercial applications. So again, just to kind of start off with, I believe the software initially was called Gumpy. There's still a website up available, so anybody can go and check that out. I wanted to understand, what was the difference between Gumpy and MyBrain? And then there's a free version of this software. So how do you distinguish between the free version and the version that's going to be applied in the commercial part of the company?
Yeah, I think a very good question. This goes back to historically how and why we started this whole project. This might be, you know, give a little bit of kind of insights into why we started this, you know, from the beginning. And actually, when I started the PhD in brain machine interfaces, I kind of looked it around and tried to find like a toolbox which can be easily used off the shelf to develop some machine learning models and signal processing ideas. But somehow I couldn't find something that's intriguing, and is like kind of easy to use. And that's why I took up the challenge and they said, okay, let's build something so that we can help the community use it and develop like advanced the field. So there were a lot of people who contributed actually to the project. We published the paper as an open source and then we made the whole software publicly available under an MIT license, and it's called Gumpy. Actually, one of my colleagues gave it this name. I don't know, like, even right now, I don't know, like, why it's called Gumpy, but don't ask me here. And then, actually, after that, then Sameher came into the whole game, and then she came up with this idea to actually, you know, find out how we can commercially use this technology. And since then, we have been putting a lot of sweat and tears into getting this into a commercial product. And as the, you know, as probably you have experienced in software development, you go through different steps or different phases. So you start from an alpha and then you kind of migrate to beta and so on and so forth. So each time we move from one level to the other, we give it a new name. So then we gave them MyBrain. This is actually probably 3 to 4 times what we had back then in 2017. And this is MyBrain, because you still like see the software is actually a BCI tool. That's the name MyBrain. And then now when we started using it, which is again 2 to 3 times what we had in 2019. So every 2 years, actually we double the content and the possibilities of what can be done within the software. Then we have the new name is called Body Mirror, and it's actually being now under protection. Yeah, so now and then the software
Does that mean it's patented? Is that what you mean by under protection?
Yeah, it's actually the name itself is patented. Obviously, it's very difficult to patent the software as a raw software, but we are also in the process of submitting patents for other algorithms we have inside the software. But the name itself is actually being now protected with the trademarks. So this is what we are doing. Yeah, and then now it's like it's not available online anymore, because that's actually the commercial version. But we decided to keep the open source version, which by the way, I'm positively surprised how many citations it has. I mean, right now it's like 2 years or less, and then it has like up to 20, 25 year citations.
Awesome. I was going to ask how many people are actually using both the free and the commercial versions a little bit further down, but it's very good to know. Samar, I'm also really interested in getting your perspective too on what was the strategy, I guess? What was the thinking behind how to actually convert this this open source, initially open source software, further develop it into a commercial application? And then do you have any thoughts around, and you know, if this is not open to the public in terms of the information, that's okay. But how do you kind of factor in the commercial steps that you've taken in terms of pricing the software?
Regarding the open source, it's for me, when I see citations and about Gumpy, I feel that, okay, so we have a big potential to start to work harder and create a new version for the commercial one. So regarding the commercial Body Mirror, so the pricing strategy is a little bit different, because it's not just licensing a software, but also getting a whole product with partnership for a hardware part. So it's let's say it's a new business model and new pricing model. So I think it's licensing, not just licensing software, but also getting pricing for our hardware we have partnership with our hardware providers, and licensing the software as a part of the product, a whole product. So it's
just adding along the same lines. It's actually you know, the business model, how we are pricing this software is through what we call subscription based. So we have different, you know, there is a value proposition of the company, which is centered, I mean, we're talking about mind and age, but it's centered or it's orbiting around the early diagnosis and remote monitoring. So for the early diagnosis, we have kind of, we have set up a first pricing strategy, because this is going to be like a one shot. You just use the software, then you get the results. The results are shared with the physician, and that's just one shot. And there is the remote monitoring, where actually the software is being used on a regular basis. And then here where the subscription model makes sense. And I think Samer has put a great kind of a pricing strategy. Unfortunately, we can't, unveil it at the moment, because it's still like negotiation and so on. It probably, how secret this should be until the negotiation is done. But to kind of, give you a bit to scratch the surface here a bit is, as I said, like we have three different options based on a subscription basis, and it could be for patients or it could be for hospitals.
Okay, so it sounds like there's a couple different solutions here that you're offering in terms of packages. Let's mm-hmm. call that loosely. Let's see if we can lay that out in as clear as possible. So there's the solution itself is actually a combination of both software and hardware. And again, I'd encourage listeners to go and check out the website. It's laid out really nicely there. So it's hardware and software. At the same time, the applications are both early sort of detection diagnosis and more long-term monitoring as well. I also want to touch on, do you have thoughts around how exactly this would integrate with other hardware or software applications that, clinicians, practitioners, hospital or private clinics would have to sort of integrate with to make this thing work? And then at the same time, there's this, distinguishing factor between this various models of subscription. So all of these are kind of coming together right now. And are they... So it sounds like some of this is already kind of laid out really nicely. Some of it is still in the process of being developed. I imagine there's some contracting related things that need to be finalized and so on. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, exactly. I think it's a great one. As you said, like we have the hardware part, which is two sensors we use. They are already certified, both CE marked and FDA cleared. I think cleared is the right word here. And the reason why we are using our own sensors, or we are relying on like kind of a partner to get the sensors, is because the sensors are very easy to use. They are wireless. It's kind of a new breakthrough, even in EEG and saliva imaging. I mean, I have got like the sensor with me. It's actually off the shelf, could be used. The amplifier is lying here around, so you don't have all those cables and wires you used to see when you're recording EEG. They have this bulky amplifier and a very clumsy solution. So just put this on your head and it's done. And then it's also dry electrodes. That's, a giant leap, a breakthrough, because usually we used to do like a lot of gel, and this is time consuming. And then as the signal to noise ratio goes down, as the quantity of gel also goes down. So those are a lot of problems. And then once we have the hardware, it's 5 minutes, then we get the data, then we have the body mirror solution, a lot of signal processing, machine learning behind the scenes. Then we generate what we call diagnostic report with the likelihood, the patterns we found in the data. It's a probabilistic model. It doesn't rely on one single input, but actually gathers all the inputs from different places and put them in one place in the cloud, and then share the results in a very high level way with a doctor and physician so that they can understand what's going on. And this is basically is being used for both purposes, the early diagnosis, because again, thanks to the EEG high temporal resolution, and thanks to the kind of this low signal to noise ratio of the system. And also it's remote monitoring, because basically we can see and monitor how the brain activity is changing, and then correlate that with the progression of the disease, or even we can mathematically interpolate and extrapolate based on the data to say, okay, what's going to happen? What's the likelihood that things will get worse over time? But just to answer your question regarding other hardware, I think the software is device agnostic. So that means it can be used with any hardware in principle, in theory. It's the reason why we give this as a full solution, just to make life of people easier, because through our app, someone can, you know, a patient can call us at any time. We come with the system 5 to 10 minutes. We set up the recording, and then the rest is done through the cloud. But at the end of the day, it's device agnostic. So any hardware can work as long as it has Bluetooth connection. It's going to be streamed, and then we have the software, and it's like can process any data.
Do you have current clinical partners that that you're using to test the device, or is it going through clinical testing at the moment?
Yeah, we are entering the clinical phase. Indeed. So we have a first partner in Germany. So this is one of the largest clinics, actually a private clinic in Germany, with whom we are starting a clinical trial. Then we also have a couple of other hospitals, different places around the world, including in my home country, Tunisia. Then we have in Egypt, because usually those studies, they are multi-center studies. So you have to involve different people also to enlarge the size and the sample size to figure out, whether this is like specific patterns are linked to a specific population and a specific characteristics of a certain person. And in addition, we are currently discussing with other partners here in Luxembourg to get them involved in the study. Our next step would be also to involve people from the US. And I'll be talking about this probably in the next few minutes.
Samara, I'm really interested as the CEO right now, have there been any challenges, let's say, or any major wins on the other hand, with respect to, pitching Myelin Age and its kind of comprehensive four-pillared solution here, the software and the hardware, to get people to come on board, either from a funding perspective or from a partnership perspective?
For Myelin Age, we need partnership as clinicians and doctors, neurologists, hospitals. So these guys, when we have more contact with them, so we will have more understanding of their vision and their needs. And specifically, we have to design our dashboard, for example, for them. So we need more contact and more partnership with them. So this is a part of partnership, as well as we really are seeking partnerships with organizations that we will have more contact with patients and normal people, but understand their how they live their day and where exactly Myelin Age can contribute there. And the other side, the financial side, so we need for a lot of funding, especially for the clinical trials as well as the certification later.
I understand that you guys are already classified as a Class 2 medical device. And so that application has already been submitted. You've already achieved the status. So I just want to say congrats for that. And right now it sounds like a lot of the testing is already underway. Or is this sort of, are you guys in the planning phase? Have you submitted a study design for research ethics? Have you already identified clinical partners at multiple sites? At what stage is that at?
Yeah, just for the sake of clarification here, I just want to correct something. It's not yet certified as a Class 2A. Okay. And that's the category where it falls under. But the submission, we have undertaken a couple of actions to start that process, but we need to back it with strong science, a clinical evidence. And that's why we're about to run those different clinical trials, to strengthen the claims and the results. But this application hasn't been, it's not yet CE marked. That's just for the sake of clarification.
I think you clarified it. Yeah. So again, the target to fix that question was you're going for a Class 2 medical device status.
Yeah.
But not yet there. And you're initiating or have already initiated some clinical studies. In terms of identifying kind of all the key components of that, including, the sites where some of the testing will be done, who will be the local PIs, the overall study PIs, is that already underway?
Yeah, so actually our approach, we've taken like different approaches to how to tackle this problem. So first of all, we started with retrospective data. So actually we got data from the US, from New Mexico. We run the software, we've gotten initial results, which are about Parkinson, early detection, and also remote monitoring of drug and treatment effectiveness. That's the first kind of initial results we have. And this is based on retrospective data. And from that, we've been able to actually use that to convince people to join us, to join the mission, to actually push the frontiers of what can be done in Parkinson's early detection and monitoring. And for that, we are kind of getting people around and interested and hooked into the whole project. Aside from that, so those are like kind of the approaches we have taken. Of course, there was the R&D part, which was preceding this kind of retrospective data. So we don't have to develop anything from scratch, but we are just using what we have and test and validate different hypotheses. The next step would be to finish this clinical trial so that we have a complete comprehensive study with strong results. And then in parallel, we'll be submitting the FDA, submit for FDA, the 510K, the common one. And in addition or in parallel, it's going to be class 2A devices here in Europe.
Okay, very interesting. All right, so all this is as actively going on right now. Really, really interesting stuff to hear. Do you have a timeline in mind for when some of these milestones will be achieved, even tentative timelines?
Yeah, we do have one. Of course, this is subject to changes. You know, nothing is kind of deterministic when it comes to clinical trials and medical devices. Things are, you know, usually unpredictable. Nevertheless, so the timeline we are pitching right now is basically as we are moving from retrospective data to prospective data and our own data, I think this is going to take us like roughly 9 months to 1 year to be realistic, to finish and have the results and so on and publish this. And I think a year from now, we'd be able to submit the CE mark and the FDA approval. So we are talking about 1 year for that. And now we have been hearing different kind of opinions about like how much time it takes for FDA and CE mark, but usually I would say it's between 9 months to a year to get the certification or to get your product FDA cleared. So we're talking about 2 years, which I think is the normal timeline for a medical device company.
Yeah, very, very reasonable for sure. This initial testing that you're approaching right now, is it for Parkinson's, if I understood that correctly? Because there are multiple applications here. You're targeting multiple neurodegenerative diseases, as well as brain cancer, I believe, is one of the applications here. But is Parkinson's the initial application for the testing?
Yeah, indeed. It's like, you know, you can't open many doors at the same time. You can't drive many cars at the same time. So you have to take a kind of step-by-step approach, and you have to test and validate your technology gradually. Specifically, those things, they take a lot of time and money. So what we decided to do is to start with Parkinson, because the prevalence of the disease is much higher than MS. And also MS is very kind of gender dependent. So it's like more common in women than men. That's at least the statistics what have shown. And now we started with Parkinson. The clinical trial will be also Parkinson. And then later on, we are moving to multiple sclerosis. So we have an investigator-initiated research. This is not a proper clinical trial, but rather like in first scratching the surface. A case study, exactly, on MS, and then we would be moving disease by disease. But for now, the focus is Parkinson. And you may ask me quickly why you wanted to start with those two diseases, because there is also scientific evidence. It's just not, it didn't happen randomly that we picked those because we love them most. The reason why we picked those diseases, and specifically Parkinson first, because both diseases, MS and Parkinson, they target the central nervous system as well as the peripheral nervous system. So for Parkinson, you see you know, damage of the midbrain because of the dopaminergic neurons, but then you see also manifestations of the peripheral nervous system, which are the tremors and the abnormal muscle activity. Whereas for MS, then you see the problem of central nervous system, and then you also see muscle weaknesses, what we usually they lead to myositis or something like that. So this is where our kind of technology of processing in real time EEG and EMG at the same time and trying to combine them makes sense. So that's why we picked those two diseases.
I love the fact that there are multiple applications of this the same technology too. I imagine that a lot of clinicians will be interested in looking at this as an option for remote patient monitoring. Really, really interesting stuff. Now, I also wanted to ask you in terms of competitors here. Have you guys done a competitive landscape? Are there companies that are doing similar works either in development right now or already on the market?
I mean, it doesn't come as a surprise that there are a lot of people, actually smart people, working around the clock to get also solutions for Parkinson and MS. So we are, there are actually a couple of competitors and they are doing good work, I think, overall. Their approach is completely different than ours. Usually, you see like two different approaches. So you see either completely invasive stuff where a lot of treatment or like targeting treatment and deep brain stimulation and this kind of things, which is very deep, but also very kind of specific because the target population is not that high. And then all you see from the other side of, on the other side of the coin, you see kind of those simple solutions, which are usually just like a couple of questions or like very simple, not simple, but at least very easy to monitor as a science. And then those are the two different approaches you've seen so far in the market. So our approach is somewhere in the middle where we are not very invasive. We were not developing drugs or vaccines, but at the same time, we are not just, you know, doing general monitoring. So we are very specific. We have specific signals. They are very complicated to process, but a lot of know-how is being put here. So there are a lot of competitors, which is, I think, a good sign, but our approach is different from a technology standpoint.
I found this really interesting too, because there are big pharmaceutical companies that are working on developing new medicines. For instance, there's no cure yet for these neurodegenerative diseases, so there's a long way to go. But I always think in terms of the treatment landscape, the treatment paradigm, and where new technologies or new medicines are going to fit within the current guidelines, if you will. And Myelin S is again very focused on early disease detection. I'm not sure if it's predictive or if it's meant to be predictive, and it also has an application for long-term monitoring as well. So I wonder if you can speak to that a little bit in terms of, you know, a couple of years down the road, the product is already launched on the market, it's fully commercialized, available to clinicians and other partners to actually use. You know, where would it fit in everyday clinical practice when people are actually getting treated or diagnosed, let's say, for any of these diseases?
Yeah, so one of the, you know, main problems in neurodegenerative diseases, specifically Parkinson and MS, those diseases are progressive. So they change their behavior or they progress quickly and usually silently. So they take some time until you see like symptoms and to move from one phase to the other quickly. And one of the things we realized is that we need to actually monitor how effective is the drug or the treatment. As you said, there is no curable treatment, but at least, you know, to see the effects. For example, the Lipodova, which is the common treatment for Parkinson, it's actually just alleviating the tremors and the whole disease. What we've done in the clinical study, like the one with retrospective data, is we picked EEG data for Lipodova off and on medication, and we were able to extract specific patterns, biomarkers related to whether the subject is on and off medication. Now, the reason why we are doing this is I think it gives a lot of information to the clinician or the physician whether the body is being responding to that treatment, because that's one of the issues with Parkinson. At some point, the body gets gets used to that particular treatment and it's no longer effective. So this is one of the applications which we are, you know, the reason why we're doing this. Now, on the other side of the spectrum, pharmaceutical companies, as there is no treatment, they would need to understand when they develop new drugs, whether they are effective or not. And this is basically by monitoring beyond the clinical trial, how the body is responding and getting more snapshots of what's going on inside that body. And this is where mileage technology can be of help, because we can give them on a regular basis new data, and that can help them understand how effective is that treatment they are developing, and hopefully speed up, you know, the whole, you know, kind of the whole market of developing drugs for Parkinson's or MS.
I wanted to ask you too, so because you mentioned a couple studies, where can people go to actually take a look at these? I don't know if everything's been published yet. I know, Ziad, I know you have a publications list on PubMed. Didn't have a chance to look at the full list, but is that the best place to reach, or do you guys have like a news link on your web pages where people can go and look at ongoing publications?
So yeah, indeed, there are a couple of publications which are available about like mainly about the technology in its broad sense, so how we do it and so on. I mean, not the whole secret sauce, but at least some, you know, parts of it. But regarding this particular study, it's gonna be submitted, and actually it's under review right now. So hopefully it's gonna be published very soon. Aside from that, we don't have specific publication about Parkinson and MS. So this is our one, like our first publication. It's gonna be hopefully published very soon. So fingers crossed for a smooth review process, and keep you updated when it's online.
All right. I would love to talk a lot more about myelin age, because I think there's a lot more interesting components to get into. Again, also, as you're going through the clinical trial, clinical testing phase, I think this is where things really start to happen. And a lot of big milestones become very visible. So we'll have to put that to the side just for a moment, because I'd love to also now transition into Myelin S. So this is a space company that you guys have co-founded, essentially based on the same underlying foundation, the same underlying software, but with a totally different application. And I found this fascinating. Again, it's one of my two big passions, if you will. Let's dive into that a little bit. Take a pause from Myelin H. Now, to start off, I read that you guys were finalists, I believe, or won a top 10 position in the NASA iTech competition from 2019. There was a competition down in New Mexico. I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about that. And also opening it up to, you know, what is Myelin S? How does it work? And how do you envision applying the same technology to spacecraft, I guess?
Yeah, I'll be just briefly describing this and then giving the floor to Samer for further information. So we were flattered that, you know, NASA iTech, you know, picked us and selected us as one of the top 10 most innovative startups. It was back in 2019. It was a great pleasure, I think, to be in New Mexico and to pitch the idea to a couple of departments at NASA. So Myelin S, in a nutshell, is, as you probably can link it to this year of doing neuromorphic computing research and robotics in the HPP project. Yeah, it's actually building a power efficient operating system that acts as a semi-autonomous brain for spacecraft and robots. And the reason why we decided to kind of go or, you know, tackle this problem is we realized by looking at the literature and also checking what NASA and other space agencies are doing is there is a problem as we are gravitating towards in-space autonomy. So we want to like robots and humans to work together and build like new infrastructure for a habitable Mars or moon, then this in-space autonomy is not possible because we have two problems. The first one is high latency. So we can't get the, you know, this communication fast between the human controller and the robot. And if we go with a fully autonomous system, then there is a problem of high power consumption, specifically as we want to do like deep learning and AI and pushing the boundaries of what can be done there. So ModernS is now proposing this kind of solution where it puts a lot of AI into the game and for in-space autonomy, but it leverages neuromorphic computing to do it in ultra low power consumption and low latency. And for those who are not familiar with the neuromorphic computing, is basically there is a problem right now as we are designing computers and microcontrollers using what we call von Neumann architecture and using a Moore's law, which is basically doubling the number of transistors every 18 months. Now, as we are reaching the limit of physics, because we are probably around 10 nanometer surface of a transistor, then we can no longer double the size of transistors within a microchip. But we are pretty much excited about AI and we wanna like scale and have multiple systems. So we need to figure out a way to do that. And then some people came up with the idea of developing biologically inspired computers that they can run massively parallel. The problem is when you try to use von Neumann architecture, you usually spend the whole, like the most energy and time just fetching the data from a local memory. And there is a clock which is synchronized with the whole process and then going back and forth between the memory. That's very time consuming. That's also very energy consuming. So if you have multiple memories, you have multiple chips within the same like big chip, and it's like similar to the human brain architecture. So you can drive your car while thinking about your job and then while reading a book and while checking your mobile phone. So you can do multiple things at the same time. And this is kind of the dream. This is what we live for right now, is to get this in space.
I'll open the floor up to you, Samara. Tell us a lot more about this this company and how it works exactly.
How it works. So let me first of all say about ModernS. As Ziad said, so we provide this disruptive software operating system that acts as a semi-autonomous brain for robots and servicing satellites. So as explained Ziad, we use the neuromorphic computing, plus they share the control and the sense of touch for different applications in space. That's why ModernS now we are, our vision is to attract more businesses and space companies to test our technology and also hopefully to contribute to one of the next missions in space.
There's definitely a lot of follow-up points here. So let's clarify first, when we say semi-autonomous, what exactly does that mean? Is the person still involved in any of the work when we say semi-autonomous?
Yeah, exactly. So it's like kind of this developing like something which is trustworthy is basically there's a human controller who acts as a very high level person that can intervene when something goes wrong. But the robotic system is already empowered with the capabilities to run those specific tasks without the human involvement. So it's a teleoperation mode. You send very high level commands, then the robot takes care of all the low level commands. And for example, one of the applications we are interested in at ModernS is on-orbit satellite servicing. So if you have a robotic arm attached to a satellite, and then this arm is supposed to grab another satellite, which is expired, or to fix this satellite, then the human controller can send just the high level command saying, I want to grab this satellite, or I want to repair it or fix it or refuel it. And then all the low level stuff like trajectory planning, force and so on, they will be done by the robotic system itself. And then the human controller will receive the haptic feedback to tell how much, for example, stiffness was applied when opening that tank for refueling and so on and so forth. And again, I think to complete the story, everything runs efficiently, low power consumption, talking about milliwatts and low latency.
Maybe we can rewind a little bit too. So because Mylan-H, I believe, was developed first, and then Mylan-S, or were the two companies developed simultaneously, and how did that thinking even come about? Because they're operating in very different industries, which is what I find really fascinating.
Yeah, historically speaking, I think one started before the other. So we could not, I think it's very challenging to start two companies at the same time. you might be surprised that Milan S actually started before Milan H. There was an R&D part, and then we stopped. Then we started the Milan S because there was this NASA selection. We started. We share a big passion for space anyway. That's kind of our like intrinsic motivation. Then we started the Milan S company. Things take time with the space. So you have to put one foot after the other. You have to do a lot of development. It needs ferocity, persistence, and so on. So we've been waiting, but we know in the back of our head that this thing will take too much time because it's disruptive. It's new and also space related projects. So the timeline is probably 5 years or so to get this, to see it like in action. And then we were lucky to get the support from the Ministry of the Economy in Luxembourg. The government actually believed in us as a team and also believed in our idea. And then they said, okay, I want you guys to continue working on this project, specifically the healthcare project, and take it to the next level. And so far, we started that project in January. And since then, we have been, working around the clock on the Milan H to get it off the ground.
Let's expand on that a little bit. This is a question I wanted to ask in terms of your partnerships and really other agencies that have taken an interest in Milan S. I wonder if you can, both of you can speak to, who else is involved, who's on the advisory panel for Milan S, and do you have ongoing discussions with space agencies really around the world? You mentioned Luxembourg. Are there any others involved?
Yeah, so I mean, running two different projects with cutting edge technologies and big markets is actually it's a big team effort. And then we have a lot of people who are supporting us, behind the scenes and helping the company move the needle. We have a team of people dedicated for both companies. And then we are surrounded by strong advisors. When it comes to the space, we have a couple of people from JPL, NASA. We have from the European Commission for Space. Then we have also from the Singapore space agencies, like preparing itself to be a space agency. I think it's quite a big team in terms of advisors. And they are giving us a lot of help when it comes to the space. Also in the medical field, we have physicians with us on board from Germany, from NHS in the UK. We also have business advisors. So this is a big team effort, and a lot of people are supporting behind the scenes. In terms of partnership, fingers are crossed for a new big partnership with one of the largest space robotics company. I leave the floor to Samer, but I don't want to touch on this because I want to keep it, until it's officially unveiled. But we are working on a partnership. We are, discussing with NASA every now and then, the NASA ITech team. We have also gotten different partnership discussion with ESA. So, but things take time.
So about the partnership also, you forgot to mention yet that NASA ITech, that there are a lot of companies that we are still in contact with them, and maybe we will have very soon different partnerships with them. So this is
we have a running project with a company that's not secret, so called Space Industries. One of the NASA ITech batches, or participated in one of the NASA ITech batches. We got introduced to them, and then they are developing a lunar rover to support the NASA Artemis mission 2024.
Really cool. Okay, this is one of the things I wanted to ask you guys about. Perfect. So so it sounds like there are partnerships, potential contracts maybe down the road, both with private companies and then also with government agencies, government space agencies. Is that the more long-term kind of vision of partnering with both private and public sector?
Yeah, exactly. I think the only way to go is to have a partnership with both sectors. As you can see, the tendency of NASA is gravitating towards having more private companies being involved in the space sector by giving a lot of contracts. Recently, Honey Robotics, a couple of other companies, Maxar and so on. So I think it would be interesting as the market is flourishing, there would be more private companies, and we would definitely want to, you know, position ourselves as playing with both. And I think the good thing about space agency is there is a quote which says, like, on the shoulder of a giant, you can see better. And usually with a space agency, you can see better because they give you, like, the whole thing. But it's still interesting to keep an eye and work with private companies.
Really cool to hear. Again, I mean, I wish we can continue this conversation for a couple hours. To be honest, there's a lot of really cool stuff to get into right now. But let me also try to touch on, how do you guys handle your everyday schedules? What is that like? You're operating two companies right now. You've got ongoing research, tons of partnerships, tons of teams, I imagine, that you're working with. What's your everyday schedules like? And how do you coordinate with each other?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of schedule, I think it's pretty chaotic. So it's like, you know, we're working around the clock. So you see, you know, 13, 14 hours, that's normal, because we know you have to put a lot of sweat and tears right now. This is a very kind of crucial phase for both companies. And then you obviously have to work hard to get things done. And then also there is, you know, I don't know what the weekend means. I mean, it has been a while. I didn't actually, you know, I haven't taken days off. So the schedule, I think, runs from 6 a.m. the morning till whatever, 8, 9 p.m. I can, you know, keep, I can just hand over to Samer. She can talk about her schedule. But we pretty much see each other like every day.
Yeah. So for me, my schedule is really tough to explain how it's really have a lot of tasks to do. So as I didn't mention in the beginning, that I'm also a co-lead in Space Generation Advisory Council and also a master's student at the university in the space at the University of Luxembourg. So I had to have a suspension this semester due to a lot of work in the two startups with teams, with managing, and as well as coding. So this is something a little bit hard, but it's amazing when you are doing something that you are enthusiastic and you are happy to do something and you see the progress day after day.
That's a lot of things to juggle. That's a lot on your plate. Wow. Yeah. Okay. So what would you say is the main sort of the main project or the main thing that you guys have on your plate right now for space for Mylan S first, and then for Mylan H second? What are the biggest things on your plates?
I firmly think that for Mylan H, I think the most interesting or the most important milestone to achieve is basically to have the certification. So to pass the certification process, that's one of the big milestones and the objectives we are working on right now. Of course, I mean, there are a lot of, you know, kind of other objectives, like having, you know, getting more funding to actually grow the company, double the headcount, and having more people involved. But that's actually not the primary focus. So the primary focus so far is on certifying the product and get it, on the market. The grand vision is probably in 10 years from now, or I don't know, 5 to 10 years from now, is actually to have not just diagnosis and monitoring, but actually to close the loop, to have a bi-directional brain-machine interface system. Not just reading from those like tiny microvolts, but also writing to the brain, a couple of, you know, a tiny microvolts to actually stimulate specific regions and to move from diagnosis into kind of treatment. That's probably gonna be the most exciting thing and we would love to work on, and it's probably kind of the grand vision 5 to 10 years from now, be able to have a full solution, like a closed loop system. For Mylan S, I think the biggest, the most important milestone is actually to get the system up and running on a spacecraft or like a, you know, a physical system, either from a space agency or a private company that's about to launch their spacecraft. So that's, I think, the most important milestone. And I think the grand vision here is to be able to see the system on the moon or on Mars. I mean, that's going to be fabulous. I mean, it's fantastic. Last time when we were watching like the Perseverance landing, and I think it's fabulous. It's just unbelievably good to see like a rover that can, you know, listen, collect sound, and also see what's going on Mars. And hopefully Mylan S system, the neuromorphic architecture and the software can be one day there to also help explore other planets and to help, you know, build a sustainable presence on the moon and on Mars.
I was going to ask you about the Perseverance rover and what you guys think about that. So you beat me to it. Awesome. Okay. I guess one final question, because I know we got to wrap up, unfortunately, but are you looking to bring on any additional partners right now, or are you eyeing anyone? Is there anyone in particular that you have in mind, public, private organization or other, for both Mylan S and Mylan H?
I think having more clinical partners would be definitely helpful, would be tremendously helpful, like to have a clinical partner specifically from the US, like because we want to involve, like we are planning to go for the FDA approval, and obviously we need some clinical partners there to help us. And for the space sector, we are open, and we would be interested in running a couple of pilot projects with other private companies, space companies mainly, who are about to launch, or they have their system and they want to test like a new technology and see like the benefits that can bring up to the table. So we're definitely open and be happy to discuss with any partner, both in space, robotics, or in someone who is interested in clinical trials for Parkinson specifically, and later on, hopefully on multiple sclerosis.
Great to know. All right, Ziad and Samar, it's been awesome having a chance to get to know a little bit about your companies and your backgrounds and how all this kind of came to be. It sounds like everything is still in an early stage, but very much ramping up and a lot of interesting things happening simultaneously. So I wish you guys all the best. I'd love to stay in touch and have you guys come back on in a couple months, even a year or so. And, you know, I'd love to hear a lot more about what's happening with the company. I wish you guys all the best, lots of success. I think a lot of good can come from this. And I guess we'll catch you next time.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having us. Great. It was great talking to you, and looking forward to following up on this with a nice conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Dorian.
Take care.
Bye-bye, Tom.
Bye.